Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. Today, I'd like to welcome to the program William Kennedy. He has a new novel out. It's called Shango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes. He joins us by telephone from Atlanta. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, sir, very much, Vic.
I'm so glad to have an excuse to interview you. I've dreamed of interviewing you for many years, and this is the first book you've put out in a while, isn't it?
It is. It's been 9 years since Roscoe came out, and 2002, and this has occupied me in those intervening years, among other things. I have read the New York City Writers Institute, which I'm very involved with. I also wrote a play, more or less. Didn't finish it, but. And it, you know, did a lot of other things that occupy the days. But this has been my main thrust since Roscoe, and it's been a complicated one because of the extensive history of both the Cuban Revolution and the Cuban history, and also the civil rights movement, which I was very much involved in. But it's been a long time.
So you're saying that there are some definite elements of autobiography seeping through in this one?
Well, in autobiography in the sense that I did cover the civil rights movement, and I did cover the Cuban Revolution from Miami when I was down there in 1957, which is when the novel takes place. And Fidel is up in the hills, and students from the university and some old-timers from the... Spanish Civil War gathered together and invade the palace and try to kill Batista, the president, and they don't quite succeed, and many of them are killed. And and that I was around when that happened, and I got to know some of the people who got away and came to Miami to reorganize the movement and go back and fight the revolution from the mountains. And that was a very, very heady time for me. And I always wanted to turn it into fiction.
You are a journalist who created another career as a novelist. Back in 57, when you were covering that particular story, who were you reporting for?
I was at the Miami Herald at that time. And it was a great paper at that time. I was very fond of the people who I was working with, and it was a great assignment, covering the Cubans and a lot of other things. But I left it a year later to write fiction. It was the first time I quit journalism. I quit it many times. I always had to go back to work because I needed to make a living.
You never really quit it, do you?
Yeah, well, I still haven't really.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is I haven't really written for a daily newspaper in a long time, but I've done quite a lot of journalism over the years.
You reported for a number of years for the newspaper in Albany, New York, and Albany is such a crucial element in so many of your books. What is it about Albany?
Well, I was born and raised there. I went to school there, and I went in the Army and went away for a year to another newspaper. And then I came back after the Army, and I got a job in Albany, and I worked there for 3.5 years and got my feet deeply wet in the business, and then I went to the Caribbean. That's when I went down in the middle 50s to Puerto Rico and into Miami. And after 7 years, I came back, and I went back to work for the same newspaper, only part time, because by this time I'd committed to writing fiction, and I was a full time fiction writer and a part time journalist. But that's when I discovered when I was in Puerto Rico, I discovered Albany, and I didn't think I'd come back ever. And I really had no plans to write extensively about it, but once I started, I got really hooked. I mean, I got hooked on the history. I got hooked on. I started interviewing everybody I talked to, and especially if they were old and they could disappear. I wanted to get the history way back as far as I could with the family and everything. And so, you know, and then I discovered what a great town Albany is, what great history it has, and how extensively recorded it is. And so I fell into a treasure trove for a writer, you know. I just never wanted to do anything else. And there's so much to. This is my first venture really outside of Albany. You know, I went to New York on some of the novels, but this is, you know, the Cuban escapade is quite different for me.
William Kennedy joins us. His new novel is Chongo's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, and the book does open in Albany. We have a brief prologue in the 1930s, and a young boy named Quinn is observing as Bing Crosby shows up and someone's hauled in a piano.
Right. Yeah, well, I had to use Bing, and I had to use the song Shine, which I grew up with. I bought that record, a Brunswick album of Bing Crosby singing with the Mills Brothers and all by himself, and a green label Brunswick album, and it was magical to me. It was Crosby in 31, 32, and maybe a little further in some of the other tunes, but Shine and Dinah. Dinah became a number one song in the country as Crosby and the Mills Brothers recorded it. And at the same time, they recorded this song, Shine, which had origins in back in Black Theater in 1911, musical, black musical called His Honor the Barber. And it was kind of a post-minstrel show kind of theatrical venture, and with a little bit of a plot, which was kind of different for black musicals. And this song was sung by a woman named Ada Overton Walker. It was an extremely popular song. And over the years after that, so many major, it entered the jazz canon, and it became, you know, Satchmo made it. I think Billie Holiday sang it. I'm not sure who all sang it, but there were many. And then Crosby and the Mills Brothers made it in 31. When I heard it, it just registered. And I, in later years, I decided I had to put it in a novel. I didn't know how, but I was going to do it. And that's how I did it. I brought Crosby to Saratoga, where he used to come, by the way. And he played golf and had horses running in Saratoga. And so he was around in about Albany. As a matter of fact, he stayed in my little town of Averill Park, where I live, and somebody's house there. He was a guest. And so Crosby is he comes by his presence in Albany naturally. And but I was a great fan of his, and the Mills Brothers also. And so this little, it's not quite a prologue. It's just a moment in time that where the song gets crystallized and in Quinn's mind, and he's the narrator of the book, and I finally did it. I got the song in the book, and it now runs through the whole book, of course, and then right up to the finale when Cody Mason, a jazz stride pianist, plays it in great variations. So that's music just caught me and held me, and there's music, all kinds of music in the novel, a lot of jazz and a lot of popular music.
Well, Quinn's dad is a treasure trove of classic jazz, and we'll get to him in a moment. You shoot us into Cuba then, and Quinn is a journalist, and he's there. It's 1957, as you alluded to earlier when you were in Miami. There was this tragic attempt at a revolution in 1957 where they failed. And Quinn is there, and he goes into this bar where he runs into Hemingway. But the most thrilling part of it is he's electrified because he sees this just incredibly attractive woman.
Right.
He's floored.
He's floored, right. He falls in love, love at first sight, at first instant. And, he just talks in the first breath before he meets her. He talks about marrying her. Then he meets her. And he continues to talk about it. And he pursues her very vigorously. And circumstances. She's very much involved. She's a very unusual character. She's a debutante, but also a clandestine revolutionary. And she's very much involved. One of her lovers is she has at least two at the moment, and he gets involved with this attack on the palace, and I won't say any more about that. But Quinn winds up by seeing her, he's near the palace when the attack takes place, and he's a journalist, and he's just applied for a job, and so he naturally covers the event and calls it into the paper to the Havana Post, where he's provisionally on the staff and trying out for a job, and he covers the he's Johnny on the spot, you know, and he's so he gets his job by covering the revolution. Anyway, that's how it happens with Quinn, and then his involvement with Renata continues immediately as soon as the revolution, as soon as the palace attack subsides, and he takes care of her and tries to get her to her home and so on. And that's the beginning of the romance.
And this middle section is just a steamy section because, number one, you're in Cuba. There's revolution going on. He's crazy about this woman, and she is she's a wild, wild woman. She's an incredible character. And we've got Fidel Castro hiding out in the mountains. And then there are the shadows of the past that always loom so large in your novels. And Quinn, a lot of your readers will recognize that name, Quinn. And here he is following in the footsteps, in a way, of his grandfather.
Right. Well, Daniel Quinn, the first, who was the hero of my novel, Quinn's Book, that book took place, he was born in 1835, and it goes from about 1847 when he's 12 until 1864, during the opening of the Saratoga racetrack, and then Quinn is there. He's back from the Civil War, which is still raging in the South, and he's a journalist. He's a traveling journalist, one of the early traveling correspondents, and after the war, he keeps on as a roving journalist, and he goes out and covers Custer in the West, and he goes invades Canada with the Fenians when they try to attack Canada to take it over and use it as a springboard to try and take Ireland back from England. And then he's also goes to Cuba in 1870 or 71 when the revolution that began down there, they call it the 10 Years' War. 1868 it started, and there was a man who started it was Carlos Manuel de Cespedes, and he was a sugar planter with slaves, and he frees his slaves and announces that he's starting to wage war against the colonial powers, and there is a group of revolutionaries ready to go, and they do begin their attack on this particular town, And so the war begins in 1868, and it goes on for 10 years. And the Spaniards try to, they vilify Cespedes, and they say he's dead, and the revolution is over, and so on. And there's very little communication, and they control the whole country, of course, and all of Cuba. So Quinn is a journalist after the war, goes down and tries to prove that Cespedes is still alive, and he goes up into the mountains, and he finds him. And then he comes back, and it's a precarious journey and so on, and but he verifies the revolution and writes extensively about it, and then he writes a book looking for the hero, going to see the hero. And then this book becomes an artifact that the young Daniel Quinn in 1950s discovers. And when he reads it, he is galvanized, and he wants to do something like this. And he eventually does, and he goes back to Cuba to do that, because the revolution is in full sway in 1957 when he's close to Cuba at Miami. And then he begins also to follow in his footsteps of his grandfather, in the sense that he's trying to find and prove the Castro is around and not dead, as the army keeps saying. Castro is dead, he's been killed, and they put his picture on the front page of the newspapers, and they deny he's even in Cuba. And so Quinn has a mission, and that's what he does, and Renata goes with him. So it's rather adventurous time for them both, and some very, very difficult things happen.
I love the Cuban section, but then we go back to Albany, and it's 1968, and this is a section where there's one part in particular that really resonates with me, and that's where we meet George, Quinn's father, and the day is in it's the day in 1968 when Robert F. Kennedy, who's been campaigning out in California for the Democratic presidential nomination, has been shot. And he hasn't died yet. We all know he will. But it's during that day, and there's racial unrest going on in Albany. And then there's Quinn, who's trying to report for the newspaper, and he's trying to find a safe place to put his dad, because his dad's got some memory issues.
Right. And he parks him, he thinks, at the Elks Club, where his father is a member. And he asks the guy who's the custodian of the Elks to keep an eye on him, and then he'll be back in a couple of hours to get him and take him back home or something, whatever. But George is very, very forgetful of whatever happens in the instant. And a very commonplace thing, as we know, with people with Alzheimer's. And maybe George doesn't have Alzheimer's, but he has some form of dementia, and this short-term memory erases what he's told very quickly. And so he loses track of where he is, and he never gets into the Elks Club, and he starts roaming the city. And so there's an odyssey that he works out, and he tries to cash a check in a bank, and then he goes back. And he walks up the street toward City Hall, toward the courthouse where he works. And he hasn't worked lately. He's been out of work. But because of his eye operations and all sorts of things intervene. And he meets various people. And he winds up over in the Havana Club, which he knows. He's been there. And he meets an old girlfriend of his who he hardly can remember, but she remembers, and then the story picks up from there, and he gets involved with several of the main characters in the novel, including a radical priest and a black a wino who's also a radical and very much a midst of the Black Power movement that's on in this period, and so George is very, very much in the thick of all this racial discontent that's going on in the city and the rioting. Some rioting happens, and people are throwing Molotov cocktails, and there's fights and shootings, and this all happened in Albany and in many other cities in these years. And I've telescoped a lot of it into this particular day, but wasn't an unusual. It's not an entirely unusual day for what happens in the novel, and I think a lot gets told about that period, and George is in the middle of it all, not understanding what's going on now, but very much involved in what was happening in Albany in this comparable period in 1910 when Jack Johnson beat Jim Jeffries in the riots in the cities all over the country, and George was very much in the middle of a riot back then, so... You have two parallel kind of racial matrixes happening at the same time in different eras of the country, and seen through Clint's eyes and his father's eyes.
This was such a sweet tour that we get with George, as George keeps singing snatches of old songs and remembering all the places in old Albany, and he's got this wonderful woman with him who is so understanding and protective of him. And meanwhile, he's in the eye of the hurricane, and he's almost blissfully unaware of it. And I just love this section. And it really resonated with me because my dad used to tell stories back in the 30s in Chicago when he was in high school. He had a very brief career as a numbers runner. And to hear what George used to do, and people would see him and they'd recognize him, and the whole story of the numbers racket and the corrupt Albany political machine, the Democratic machine, all intertwined here. It was just bliss to read.
Well, that's true. I mean, the numbers were very big in the 30s when this... And the 20s, back in George Quinn's day, and my father was that too. So he wound up a deputy sheriff, but he had an early career as a numbers runner.
Oh, we have that in common. Well, I'm looking at the clock. I don't know where the time goes.
We talked a lot.
I have one kind of off the subject question. I understand that you were a good friend of Hunter Thompson's.
Oh yeah, sure. Hunter and I were old friends, and I knew him for 45 years. He applied for a job when he was about 22 years old in 1959, when I was running a newspaper in San Juan, and he applied for a job, and he wrote this very arrogant letter, and I decided not to hire him, and I sent him a very arrogant rejection letter. And he got it when he was hitchhiking back to Louisville. And then he, as soon as he opened the mail and got it, he sat down and wrote me a scathing letter. He was going to come down and do a lot of violence to this newspaper editor who didn't know anything. And, you know, it was a part of the dry rot of American journalism. So I wrote him back and I said, "You're such a hot shot about the dry rot of American journalism. Why don't you write us an article for the first edition of our newspaper? We're going to start one in November, and November 2nd is our first. You write me three double-spaced pages. I'll pay you space rates and give you house room, which probably nobody else would give you." And so he wrote back and he said, "Well, yeah, you just want to mangle a hippie is what you want to do, but I'll write it, and then you probably won't print it." And he was right. I didn't print it. I rejected it again, but it was scatological. It was unprintable, but anyway, he wound up saying, "Well, you may not be such a bad sort after all." And he wound up coming about 3 months later, 2 months later, he came down to San Juan and I walked into the city room, and we went out and had a drink, and we remained friends for 45 years. And this whole story is told in his the first edition of his letters, The Proud Highway. And he wanted to reprint all the letters, and he did. Not all of them, but, you know, we wrote each other for many, many years, but... But all of us the back and forth for the, how we got to be friends. It's there, and I wrote an introduction to the letters and to the book. It's called A Curse of the Bronze Plaque or something like that. I mean, there was a bronze plaque on the Pulitzer Building in Times Square, and he quoted it a little bit for me and told me that was what journalism was really all about. And I told him he should write a novel about the bronze plaque, and he said he was going to come down and shove the bronze plaque far up into my small intestine. So The Curse of the Bronze Plaque, I think I may have the run. But it may not be the curse, but it's close. Yeah. Whatever it is, and there it is in the Proud Highway. So that's the story of Hunter.
Well, it's just been a delight to have you on the program today.
Okay, very, very good. And I thank you, Vic. I thank you for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been William Kennedy. His book is Shango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Here's an excerpt from the new book by William Kennedy. Quote, when Quinn began publishing his own novels in later years, he looked at the notes he had made about Hemingway and about himself after this improbable night, and he understood there were important things he had left out, just as Hemingway had left things out when they talked. But as Hemingway had said, you can't leave out what you don't know. And in these years, he had three novels in progress and could not stop writing them or make them come together with meaning the way he could in the old days, because now everything had unendingly equal meaning, equal value. And he had left that out when he talked about it. Yet one must persevere. One must defy the forces that try to kill the spirit. One must not only persevere, one must prevail. And so Hemingway kept writing about what it was that was trying to ruin him, and the work became a love song to that. His 1-2 punches were part of it, just as Joe Cooney's Cellar Door was the Cooney love song to his own lack of talent. Witness my absent gift. See how well I apply it. Failure can also be a creative act, Quinn decided. One must look straight ahead as one makes the forced march backward into used history. The death of ambition, gentlemen, is a great impetus for grasping this, and soon you will thrill to how urgently you are moving, how truly exciting this quest for failure can be. What you do not know at this point is that your quest for failure may also fail. Tune in next week when we'll be joined by another octogenarian guest. He's 89 years old. Senator George McGovern has just published What It Means to Be a Democrat. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.